Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And believe it or not, there are now less than 2 months to go until Election Day. The polls have been tightening. Hillary Clinton has been talking more to the media this week. And Donald Trump showed up on RT America, as in Russia Today. So let's get to our weekly 2016 roundtable.
Here and Now.
Just a couple more months, you guys. Enrique Acevedo joins us. He's news anchor at Univision. Hi, Enrique.
Hi, Robin.
And we have Margaret Talib as well, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. Hi, Margaret, to you as well.
Hi, Robin. Great to be with you.
Let's start with Donald Trump, interviewed by Larry King for RT America. It's part of a Russian news outlet funded by the Russian government, and it's Larry King's podcast that airs on it. And Trump said things like it was probably unlikely that Russia hacked the Democrats' computers in an effort to impact the U.S. election, although, as we know, the U.S. government is now investigating claims like that. And yesterday, Hillary Clinton slammed Donald Trump for praising Russian President Vladimir Putin, you know, saying he was a stronger leader than Obama in that National Security Forum. Let's listen to a little of Clinton.
I was just thinking about all of the presidents that would just be looking at one another in total astonishment. What would Ronald Reagan say about a Republican nominee who attacks America's generals and heaps praise on Russia's president? I think we know the answer.
So, Margaret, what is Trump's campaign saying today about even more, you know, airing comments on Russian television?
Well, this is an extraordinary story. And the sort of immediate effort to tamp down the RT interview was a statement by Trump's spokesperson saying that this was supposed to be a favor to Larry King. They didn't know it was going to sort of – they didn't understand what it was for. But Donald Trump is heading into this Value Voter Summit in Washington, D.C., where these are socially conservative voters – who many of them may actually be very interested, not just in the Reagan legacy, but in foreign policy in Russia. And I'm quite interested to see kind of how this plays. But this has been an extraordinary development this week, the evolution of this from this NBC forum earlier in the week where Trump praised Vladimir Putin's 82% approval rating in Russia and said that he was a stronger leader than Barack Obama, right, to the strategy the next day of kind of doubling down on
it. Well, and of course, as the campaign saying, we didn't know that was a favor to Larry King. We didn't know it was airing in Russia. Of course, people are saying, why didn't you know? I mean, the campaign's supposed to know things like that.
Well, that's sort of the other half of this. Mm-hmm. This is what the Clinton campaign would seize on if the subject matter itself weren't so sort of juicy and delicious to kind of dig into, is that if you're actually going to be president, you have to be really careful about, you know, who you're talking to, why you're talking to them, understand the context of things rather than just agree to do favors for friends.
So, Robin, sorry that I interrupt, but I think it's also fascinating because Trump has said he doesn't like to talk about his strategy with in the fight against ISIS. But in a way, his praise of Vladimir Putin, who has been very outspoken on ISIS and it's a force on what's going on in Syria, it's very revealing of what his strategy might look like in Syria and against ISIS.
In that he supports Vladimir Putin, yeah.
Exactly.
Well, let me ask you about another sort of long ago Trump scandal or controversial statement that has kind of come back this week, and that is the fact that he led the charge that President Obama was not born in the United States. Trump was a birther. He said he wasn't born in Hawaii. And this week, not only did Mike Pence, Trump's vice president, come out and say that he believes that Obama was born in Hawaii, but also last night on MSNBC's Hardball, former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, who's a Trump supporter, said, well, he was asked about that. He was asked about this, and here's what he said.
Do you agree with that?
I confirm that, and Donald Trump now confirms that. You know, Hillary Clinton.
When did he do
campaign,
that? When did he
Hillary,
do that?
He did that.
When did he do that?
2 years ago. 2 years ago. 3 years ago.
When did he has now accepted that birtherism was nonsense.
Look, Hillary
when
Clinton's
did he do that?
Campaign. Chris, Hillary Clinton's
he did
campaign,
not do that yet. I am waiting
Hillary,
for him to do it.
Hillary.
The fact is, Enrique, he hasn't done that yet. He hasn't come out. Do you think he's going to have to at some point come out and say unequivocally, I was wrong, President Obama was born in the U.S.?
This is such an important point. Well, Trump will not give Univision an interview, but I'm hoping someone asks him if he still thinks President Obama is not an American citizen. Again, I can't believe we're less than 2 months away from the election, and no one has Trump on the record. With his answer.
Well, he will be asked in the debates. I mean, we want to take up Hillary Clinton for a second. And Margaret Tallev, try this one. Hillary Clinton has said that Trump supporters are either deplorable. You know, there are white supremacists who've endorsed him, including the Daily Stormer website and Richard Spencer. But she's also spoken about, you know, these are people, in many cases, who are genuinely angry, left behind in the economic recovery, feel they're not being listened to. How does she hammer the one group of Trump supporters without offending the other?
Her attempts to do this when it comes to coal country have really fallen flat. And if you're going to put a silver lining on it for her, you know, that kind of miscue or difficulties getting this right is a gift if you're trying to get it right ahead of the general election. But she hasn't quite figured out how to do it yet. And Ohio is probably the place where the rubber meets the road if the rest of the polling holds firm. You know, Clinton has got to find a way to talk about people's genuine concerns and disaffection and disillusionment with the economy. And it's been very hard for her to do it, in part because of the Clinton Foundation and this perception that's kind of underscored by the reports about donors and who she met with when she's Secretary of State. Okay, does it matter whether or not it's illegal, whether or not there's whether or not an investigation is ended? For a lot of these people, it really doesn't matter because it just validates the idea that she doesn't get what their struggle is.
And of course, the email saga just goes on and on. And in fact, today, the Washington Post editorial board said this Hillary Clinton email story is out of control. Quote, Ms. Clinton's emails have endured much more scrutiny than an ordinary person's would have, and the criminal case against her was so thin that charging her would have been to treat her very differently. Enrique, how long do you think that this coverage of the email scandal, the day-to-day drips, and sometimes there are no drips and they're talking about yesterday's, but how long is this going to go on?
Well, I think as long as the Clinton campaign allows it in a way, because they reacted, I think, late to this with a clear strategy. Now they seem to have one in place and their own message every time they get asked, which is a lot, like the Wall Street Journal says. But I think that came after months and months of not really knowing how they were going to react to this story. And that's in part why we keep talking about it this far into the campaign.
Well, there are candidates who wish we would talk about them more, except maybe this week. I want to just ask about Libertarian candidate Gary Johnson. He was on MSNBC's Morning Joe on Wednesday. Mike Barnicle asked him about attacks in the Syrian city of Aleppo.
What would you do if you were elected about Aleppo?
About?
Aleppo.
And what is Aleppo?
You're kidding.
No.
Aleppo is in Syria.
Okay, Margaret Tallem. Aleppo, of course, is the beleaguered city in Syria, you know, battered after 5 years of civil war. The little boy who's seen sitting in the ambulance, you know, pulled from the rubble. There's hashtags now, and what is Aleppo? USA Today had a front page story. Here's what Aleppo is.
And by the way, if you have read any story about Syria in the last few years, you know what Aleppo is. It's
right.
All over the news.
And you know, people may be forgiven. You know, they're very busy with their days, but a presidential candidate. Does this mean he's not getting on that debate stage? What do you think?
Well, 15% has been the threshold, and he's not really been close to 15% anyway. I mean, you can say 10% is closer to 15% than like 3%, but it's still not 15%. So that threshold is always looked out of reach. It's certainly hard to imagine that people who have followed the Aleppo controversy are now going to say, wow, now I really think he's, you know, a foreign policy expert. On the other hand, the way this election year has gone, he's got a whole lot more publicity out of the Aleppo misstep than he has before. But I think it demonstrates a couple of things. And one is, really how difficult it is to talk credibly about foreign policy. And it helps you to understand maybe why Donald Trump is reluctant to get into the weeds on plans, because it's so easy to get outside of your knowledge level.
And we should say that Gary Johnson said he just had sort of a brain bubble right up there with Matt Lauer this week, who's moderating, you know, and some people said he left out questions in the forum. But that can happen as well, we should say.
It can, although he has said that also he's not just said, oh, I actually know a ton about Aleppo and just space. What he said is, I need to get a lot better about this.
I think not knowing about Aleppo is like not knowing about Auschwitz during the Second World War. I mean, the Civil War has been going on for 5 years. So you can't understand today's world, especially not what's going on in Europe, without understanding Syria and Aleppo in specific.
But so, if because of this and because of other things, Johnson's campaign kind of fizzles out a little bit, do his voters go to Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, Enrique?
Well, that's a hard question. I think also a lot of voters that are going with Johnson are just disappointed in the choice they have between Clinton and Trump. So it's not about what Johnson is doing or he's not doing. It's just that he's the only other option between the two candidates they don't like.
Yeah, I think that's right, although I do think that if knowing a lot and being very substantively informed about foreign policy, it is pivotal for a voter, and they just realize that that's not Gary Johnson, it's hard to imagine that they would go to Donald Trump after kind of his sort of being pressed repeatedly on what are your details about ISIS, how would you deal with Putin in a different way than Obama has, asking Kellyanne Conway on CBS, you know, what's his plan for North Korea, and really for the answer to be, well, I don't want the bad guy, you know, to know what my secret plans are.
Yeah. Margaret Tolov, senior White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. Enrique Acevedo, news anchor at Univision. And what'd you say, Jeremy? Less than 2 months.
Less than 2 months until the election, and not long at all until the first debate, which is coming right up later this month.
So we'll be talking to you more. Thank you guys both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You may remember Tig Notaro from her viral moment in 2012. She started her stand-up act like this.
Good evening. Hello. I have cancer. How are you? Hi, how are you? Is everybody having a good time? I have cancer. How are you?
She recovered, was the subject of a 2015 documentary, and has now created a TV series called One Mississippi that premieres today on Amazon. Joining us now is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
And let's start with a clip of this new show. Here is Tig Notaro and her brother and their stepfather. They're riding in a car to their mother's funeral.
You got your eulogy ready?
No, I thought I'd do something off the cuff. Of course I have it ready. It's the last thing I'll ever say to her.
Well, it's really not the last thing you'll say to her. Because she can't hear you, obviously. The last thing you said to her was probably something like, okay, or bye.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for that.
Seems kind of dark, Eric.
Just a little. Just a touch. Yeah, so this, people who know Tig Notaro's story, she, you know, became well-known because she did this great stand-up routine that was built around a lot of tragedies that have been going on in her life, including having cancer. And there was a point in her life where she, I think, had recovered from cancer, but she was struggling with a different illness, an intestinal illness, and her mother died. And she had to go back to Mississippi to sort of reconnect with this family that she'd always had trouble connecting with and deal with that death. And this series sort of centers on that. And it opens, I mean, you know, what kind of comedy opens with the lead character's mother getting taken off a respirator and slowly dying in the hospital as the lead character watches. And so it's funny, but Amazon calls it a traumedy.
A traumedy because
basically you're seeing how these characters react to this trauma, and sometimes it's funny and sometimes it's absurd and sometimes it's very dramatic.
Well, there's another series out next Friday also on Amazon. It's called Fleabag, and this show centers on Phoebe Waller-Bridge, a British cafe owner. Let's listen to a clip here. She's trying to apply for a loan at a bank recently embroiled in a sexual harassment scandal, and she accidentally reveals her bra during the interview.
I'm sorry, that kind of thing won't get you very far here anymore.
Oh, no, sorry. I thought I had a top on underneath.
Yeah, okay.
No, seriously. In this case, genuine accident.
I can see, given our history, why you might think
no,
that.
No, seriously, I wasn't trying to. I was hot.
I take this kind of thing very seriously.
I'm not trying to shag you. Look at yourself.
Please leave.
So, Eric, that one sounds less like a traumedy, although I understand that this show also has to do with loss.
Yeah, that character has a loss in her life, and I'm not going to detail it because that would be a spoiler, but you meet this character. Phoebe Waller-Bridge is actually the actress who plays the character. The character's named Fleabag, which is interesting, and that's the name of the show too, of course. And we see her sort of trying to find her place in modern life, you know, sex, feminism, and, you know, through it all, she's dealing with sort of anger and loss. And then at the end of this pilot, you find out the loss that she's dealing with, and it forces you to rethink all of this really dysfunctional stuff that you saw in her life, and it recalibrates everything in the pilot, and of course refocuses what you're going to see to come. It's based on a stage play that was very successful in Britain, and Phoebe Waller-Bridge. Some people might remember her from the second season of Broadchurch, which was a show that aired on the BBC and BBC America. She played a defense attorney there, but here she's written all six episodes. She's the creative force and the star.
And it does make you realize that even though death is something that everyone has to deal with, that it's kind of rare for that to be so central to a show. And I'm not talking about death by being eaten by a monster or having a dragon breathe fire on you, but just ordinary death.
Yeah, you know, well, I mean, obviously, it's a topic that is tough for people to talk about or think about for an extended period. And, you know, 6 Feet Under on HBO did a great job of pointing out how much we avoid facing death in our lives. And I think these two series, it's kind of courageous in a way of Amazon to take two comedies and bring them out so close to each other and have them both deal with death and loss sort of in a more direct way. I think we're at this point in sort of peak TV or the TV, you know, explosion, where we've got to explore every nook and cranny of modern life, and we've got to take, you know, really great and unsparing looks at things that we normally try to avoid. And so it would only make sense that some creative people would come along and try to figure out a new way to talk about death and how we cope with it in our lives. And these two shows are really interesting ways of doing it. And that they're both on Amazon, I think it gives you a sense of, you know, Amazon's just trying a bunch of different things. They're trying things that, you know, other people aren't doing in an effort to get people to come to their service. And it makes a lot of sense. And, you know, these are both great shows. They're well worth checking out, not just for the performances, but for the ideas behind them.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans talking with us about two new Amazon shows. Eric, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Well, there's been lots of reaction to Airbnb's new rules to reduce racism on its room-sharing site. Airbnb said yesterday it would minimize user photos during the booking process to make it harder for hosts to deny someone a room because of race or sexual identity. Airbnb will also require anti-bias training for its employees, among other things, after complaints of discrimination, and a study last year that found that people with black-sounding names were less likely to have properties rented to them. This is just one of the stories spinning through social media. Let's check in with Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, what are people saying about Airbnb's new approach?
So, let me give you one tweet, hot off Twitter. Let's not let hosts see my, my black bleep in the first place. This is their master plan. Incredulous. And then one more from Chester Ellis. So it took them months to think it's a problem. Great job, Airbnb. So a little bit of cynicism from Twitter, but also a lot of congratulations, because the reason why Airbnb were reacting in the first place was because of a viral hashtag, Airbnb While Black, which told some horrific stories, Robin.
Of people being denied rooms. But we understand that people are saying now, wait, so your plan, as you alluded to, is that I should hide that I'm black, which is kind of what it would do to take the photo down.
Well, the process by which somebody can actually maybe see your name and decide, actually, I don't want that person to stay with me, or maybe see your face, well, that profile is going to be smaller. But before we start to maybe knock it or criticize it or push back a little bit, this is a technology that Uber uses as well. So Uber doesn't really know what you look like when it comes to pick you up. And that has changed an awful lot of discrimination in the taxi business, because there have been rumors for many years of people not being able to get a taxi because they actually come from a particularly minority group, or taxi drivers decided, I won't pick this person up. Mm. So not knowing who it is that is booking actually helps in some cases to reduce discrimination.
Huh. There's another story you noticed gathering steam online. It has to do with 9/11. Sunday marks the 15th anniversary. Please tell me this is not true, that retailers are using the anniversary to promote sales.
Yes. Promotion opportunity. If you're a Florida Walmart, for instance, just think of this, Robin, a huge banner across two soda towers. look like the Twin Towers, and the banner says, "We will never forget." And that picture has been circulating online, and people have just been pointing out how tasteless it is. Cynical and revolting, in fact, says Bill DeNome. And then here's another one here that says that this is absolutely amazing, that you could possibly use 9/11 as a branding opportunity.
Yeah, well,
it goes further than that, actually.
Well, there are other companies. Miracle Mattress in San Antonio had a promotional video for their 9/11 sale on twin mattresses. I mean, it's just really something. But we should say both Miracle Mattress and San Antonio
apologized.
Yeah, and Walmart have apologized.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, we want to talk about one more thing. The Paralympics, which I don't think is getting quite enough attention, so let's do that, taking place in Rio. Now, first of all, about a week before the Paralympics kicked off, there were concerns about ticket sales. There was an online campaign. What happened?
The ticket sales have gone down. The stadiums are almost empty. Mm. The additional staff that were brought in, the parties, the screening parties, they've all been reduced or shut down because not enough people are going to see the Paralympics.
Well, and they should be watching, because you tell us about a take-your-breath-away moment during the opening ceremony when the Brazilian Paralympian carrying the torch, well, you tell us what happened.
I found this out because of the hashtag Paralympics4. What on earth could that be? Well, that was Marcia Malsa. She was from the 1980s. She was a track and field Paralympian in the 1980s, and she was unsteadily carrying the Olympic torch. She fell over, the torch dropped, it is pouring with rain, and then she gets up to help us come to help her, pick her up, and then she continues with the Olympic torch. When I watched it a few times, I was thinking, who's cutting onions in my room? It's really hard not to tear up. It's the most amazing moment, and it really sums up the Paralympic spirit. That alone is worth following the Paralympics.
What I always say is, I have a cold.
Yes, I had a cold several times as I was watching that video. Yeah.
Femi Okay, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English, will post that moment where the Paralympian falls, is helped up by technicians, and the crowd erupts. Very moving moment. Brought to us by Femi Okay. Thank you so much, Femi.
You're welcome, Robin.
There are questions today about why thousands of employees at Wells Fargo, over 5,000, seem to simultaneously choose to flaunt regulations and common decency and open fake bank accounts and credit cards without customer permission. The 5,000 employees have been fired, and yesterday regulators announced a $185 million fine against the bank, one of the country's largest. So what happened? Michael Regan is columnist for Bloomberg Gadfly. He's in New York. And Mike, first, how the scheme worked. I mean, would someone know that an account was created in their name?
Well, that's exactly it. The customers had no idea that these accounts existed because the employees were secretly opening them without the customer's knowledge or approval. And that's what allowed it to continue for so long and to grow to such a huge amount of accounts in the neighborhood of 2 million fake deposit and credit card accounts.
This is amazing. And again, this is over years, 5,000 employees, not one rogue employee. Why would they do this?
Well, it's basically Wells Fargo is known for what's called cross-selling, which is when you have someone who, say, is a checking account customer, you try to sell them on other services, whether it be opening a credit card or maybe using one of the bank's financial advisors. And this case is highlighting the fact that the bank put a lot of pressure on employees to do whatever it takes to meet sales quotas by getting customers to open more accounts. One employee grievance from last year accused managers of berating and demeaning employees and actually threatening their employment or threatening to make them work much longer hours in order to meet these sales quotas.
It's Dickens, you know. They seem to be hounded. And in fact, your colleague, Matt Levine, writes in Bloomberg, it's like a vast uprising of low-paid and ill-treated Wells Fargo employees against their bosses.
That's right. It's unusual. You know, the financial scandals we're so accustomed to involve these, you know, traders making millions of dollars a year and, you know, exotic bets on mortgages and that sort of thing. This appears, at least from what we know, to be much lower level, you know, branch workers, low paid workers who are really just trying to keep their job and maybe qualify for a bonus. And the incentive system at Wells Fargo seems to have been so heavy-handed and, you know, not enough on the other end to ensure that these people were meeting these quotas in the appropriate way.
Well, somebody must have noticed, gee, 5,000 people are being fired here. You know, Wells Fargo, is any management going to lose a job, or is the system going to change there, do you think?
Well, it's a great question. I think that's what's on everyone's mind right now. Wells Fargo hasn't really said a lot about it. You know, they issued sort of a very short statement apologizing for it, but they haven't really given their side of the story too well. Many of the sort of lower-level managers involved in this were fired, but the question really is how high up in the bank were these practices known, and why weren't they prevented earlier? I think it's a safe assumption that a lot of people might be worried about their jobs there, all the way up and down the management chain.
Yeah. Mike Regan, columnist for Bloomberg Gadfly, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Just days before the 15th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks, the House today approved a bill allowing families who lost loved ones in those attacks to sue Saudi Arabia. 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi. The Senate approved the bill in May, 100 votes to zero. The White House has indicated that the president may veto the legislation, saying that if Americans can sue the Saudi government, foreign governments could in turn sue the U.S. So we'll keep an eye on this as the bill goes to the president's desk. Meanwhile, as the nation remembers, we want to take a few minutes now to talk about the flight that went down in Pennsylvania on that day, United Flight 93. There were 40 crew members and passengers on board who voted to take the four hijackers down, sending the plane crashing into a field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, instead of being allowed to crash in Washington, D.C. Now there's a national monument, and Kara Holsoppel of Here Now contributor The Allegheny Front paid a visit.
At the visitor center at the Flight 93 National Memorial, history repeats itself on a loop on a TV screen.
There was an early report of a plane perhaps going down in that area.
Inside, the exhibits draw people back to that day on September 11th, when terrorism hit New York, Washington, and this rural corner of southwestern Pennsylvania. But outside,
it's okay to see the beauty of the flowers and the sky above us, and it reminds us of what we love in life.
Brendan Wilson is a park ranger and interpreter. All around us are mountains and farms. It's a landscape that changes with the seasons. Wilson and I are walking down the Allee.
It's a formal walking path that's lined by trees, and we actually just planted the maple trees that surround us this spring and summer.
The trees make a wide arc, about a mile down to the crash site.
Just past them are the 40 memorial groves, so there are 40 groves of 40 trees, one for each one of the passengers and crew.
Even before Flight 93 crashed here, this piece of Pennsylvania was in transition. Right up to the 1980s, the site was stripped bare and mined for coal. So Wilson says these trees and others planted to prevent erosion and make a new home for wildlife like bear and turkeys are helping turn a new page.
We're using this land and using this memorial landscape to provide healing and renewal.
Down at the Memorial Plaza, just outside of the crash site, Beth Ann and Eric Patak from Tonawanda, New York, are holding hands. They say, of course, they remember the shock and trauma of September 11th.
The enormity of the event is symbolized by the enormity of this memorial. It is huge.
It's much larger than I expected.
But it's also made them think about how different their lives are now. Patak's teenage daughter was just born in 2001, and her husband Eric lived in a different state. She says they have Muslim neighbors and coworkers they didn't know a decade ago, and she feels a lot of pride in the diversity of her community.
Even walking through here, I was, that part of me kind of swelled up a little bit too, you know, that how far we've come from that day.
But Eric Patak says being here also makes him wonder if more could have been done to prevent the 9/11 attacks, and if we're doing the right things to stop something like it from happening again.
We were just mentioning as we were walking up, you know, in 1,000 years, is this going to mean anything to anybody? And, you know, the world's going to be a completely different place. Mm-hmm. You know, hopefully it's a completely different place for the better.
Patak says it's appropriate that the people who died here are memorialized with life, trees, grasses, and flowers, because the people who visit here can also grow and learn from what happened and maybe help to build that better world. For Here and Now, I'm Kara Holsoppel.
Well, for the first anniversary of 9/11 in 2002, we were in New York for the beginning of the ritual of the reading of the names of the almost 3,000 killed that day.
Joseph J. Zucala.
Andrew S. Zucker.
bagpipers marched 13 miles from the Bronx. And everywhere, there was loss.
My brother, Keith Roma, he was with Fire Patrol 2. He's the first fire patrolman killed in like 43 years. We miss him dearly.
But what's this? Along the Hudson River, with a straight view downtown to where the two World Trade Towers once stood, two goalpost-like steel frames enclose three-story-high platforms with riggings and a safety net. It's the then brand new Trapeze School.
Well, that was one of the points of us setting up here, because people go up with a lot of trepidation. They know what's happened here, and they come down and feeling joy, feeling alive again. There are definitely days where we all kind of stop, you know, sometimes when the sun is setting, and then we look down to the trade towers, and we know that, you know, people walking up to the rig from the north are seeing these empty frames that take the exact spot of the Twin Towers. And we say, yep, just use this as an opportunity to move through any feelings that you have. I mean, if you have sadness come up while you're flying, we know how to be with that. I mean, we're willing to be with whatever feelings come up. We know the responsibility that we're holding right now. We're really trying to help create a good energy around that and help people just remember that it's good to be alive, and this is a good, safe place to be alive. And so, yeah, we're very, very mindful of that.
Then we'll do practice bar, and then we'll...
The class is usually sold out. New flyers start instructions on the ground, then climb to the platforms in full rigging and safety harnesses.
And then hop. And hop is circus for go.
Are you New Yorkers?
Yeah, I am.
I mean, here we are. It's the week of the anniversary. How does that at all connect to what you're doing here today? Does it?
The reason why, like, originally I started to come all the way down was I wanted to see... For me, it was really difficult to get down there, and I couldn't get down there for long. And don't know, it just, here right now, it looks so peaceful, and that's the reason why I'm going to go on my life.
It seems as if that fear you were talking about a year ago, that inability to get down this far, this helped you come here.
It actually did, you know. The other day I saw a bunch of kids smiling, you know. They had a birthday party here, and I was like, oh my God, you know, kids are smiling, and I'm so glad, you know. They're like taking everything so much better. They're trying to move on, you know. Why don't I just support it? Like, I want people to come down here, you know. I want people to come here to support New York.
Is that your boyfriend going up there?
Yeah.
There it is.
Her boyfriend's up next. An instructor holds him as he leans out, gripping the platform and his trapeze.
There it is.
Back on the ground, we waiting students get a full report.
Oh, you just get this adrenaline rush. You know, it's such a high when you get up there, and then it's holding on to you, but you're kind of disbelieving that he's not going to let go.
Was it easy to let go?
Yeah, when he said let go, actually, it was great. I wanted to let go.
It's just not a natural thing, you know. You don't want to let go.
Hello. Okay, Robin, I want you to hold on with two hands. Don't let go, okay?
I haven't admitted to anyone how scared I really am, or that when I'm clutching that railing up on that platform, scanning the new skyline, I'm thinking of those people in those buildings.
Don't let go with the left hand.
But then Jason tells me, it's time to let go.
Okay, Robin, go ahead, put your left hand on the bar. I've got you. I'm not going to let you go. Good, good, good. Okay, Robin, when I say help, lift the bar by pivoting your shoulders back and then step off the board, nice and gentle, just like you're going into a swimming pool. This is Robin with an EA. Ready, up, and step off. There you go.
It turns out I'm not the only one with those feelings. A young woman in the class who hasn't said a word to anyone turns out to be the only one to successfully make a catch and release, swinging upside down from her trapeze and meeting in midair the outstretched hands from another.
Oh, oh, oh!
Was this about 9/11?
I think that probably has a little to do with why I was able to come and actually try.
What's why?
Because I just feel like now I really need to embrace life and enjoy every day and not look back, you know, so you never know what's going to happen. And I wanted to do something fun that I might not get the chance to do again today.
Lift the ball. Up, go. Hey. Hands up. Hands back.
Strong, but you needed proof. You saw her bathing.
The first anniversary of 9/11 in 2002 at the Trapeze School in New York. It's here now.
And this morning, aerial spraying began in Miami Beach, Florida, to control mosquitoes and limit the spread of the Zika virus. The spraying was supposed to happen yesterday, but was delayed after a protest. The city is using an insecticide called Naled, and officials say it's the most effective way to kill mosquitoes. They will spray again on Sunday and over the next two weekends. Joining us now via Skype is Michael Grieco, who is a Miami Beach commissioner and is opposed to the spraying. Welcome.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me.
And what are your concerns about aerial spraying of Naled to control mosquitoes and Zika in Miami Beach?
Well, it's not just my concern. It's the concern of the tens of thousands of residents that have reached out to me and have expressed their concerns. There are other options. And I think that this is a knee-jerk reaction by the local government to make it seem like they're doing something when it's not going to be effective.
Well, but what do you think will happen because of the spraying? Is this, do you think it's going to be harmful to humans or animals or other bugs or what?
We just don't know. What I can tell you is that the entire European Union thought it was risky enough to ban it. It's something that we don't need in our sky. It's something we don't need in our lungs. A lot of people fled town in anticipation of this. They had an extra day to do so. There's enough studies out there where we don't know what the short or long-term effects of dropping a neurotoxin on an urban area, what those effects might be. The not knowing has freaked out a lot of people. I'm not a scientist, but I do not think that it is a risk that we should be taking when there are other alternatives.
Are you at all comforted by the fact that the Florida Department of Health, the Centers for Disease Control, say that spraying Naled aerially is safe because it's delivered in low concentrations and it breaks down quickly?
No, and for multiple reasons. One, I don't think the Florida Department of Health has any more information than the European Union did in 2012 when they banned this. Moreover, the Department of Health actually told the residents of Miami Beach that the European Union did not ban it. When they actually did ban it, I don't believe half of the things that are coming out of the Department of Health right now. And if we all remember, cigarettes used to be safe. DDT used to be safe. The old adage, well, we do, this is the way we just do things, and this is the way we've done things for years. I don't buy that. A lot of the residents here in Miami Beach don't buy it. And candidly, they didn't ask for our permission. The county just decided to do this. And, you know, we didn't get a chance to opt out.
So what should be done about Zika then in Miami Beach?
Well, you mean what should be done about Zika or what should be done about mosquitoes? And that's the way you ask the question is the concerning part. We are trying to control the mosquito population. There are ways to do this on the ground. Instead of knee-jerking and just dropping chemicals on people's houses and schools, there are other options. You know, we live in a tropical climate. Mosquito populations fluctuate. There is an end to mosquito season. And this is an election year knee-jerk way of our county mayor and some of the local officials trying to make it look like they're doing something when they're not, especially when other counties have decided not to do this. And in fact, Miami-Dade County, back in May, our own mosquito control expert said that this is not an effective way to control mosquito populations.
So what would be an effective way to do that? Because there are obviously people who are concerned about getting bitten by mosquitoes in Miami Beach and then contracting the Zika virus.
Correct. And for every one person that's concerned, showed concern about Zika, I can find you 20 people that have come to me and they've shown more concern about having chemicals dropped on their heads. We didn't choose to have Zika contractions happen here in Miami Beach. It's not a choice that we made. And we're going to deal with it the best way that we can, with on the ground, dealing with larvicides, standing water, less toxic pesticides that can be used at the ground level, and then individual decisions regarding spraying bug spray and everything else that you need in order to keep yourself safe.
But do you think that it's going to be a given, no matter what happens now, that people are going to have to take their own precautions to avoid getting Zika in Miami Beach because there will be a population of mosquitoes there who have Zika for some foreseeable time?
Well, listen, this was not Zika popping up in South Florida was not some unforeseen consequence. This is something that folks have been discussing for the last couple of years since it popped up in South America. And unfortunately, our local county government didn't prophylactically address this. This is something you can control mosquito populations only to a certain extent, but you can do it in advance. What happened now is we're plugging the dam and playing whack-a-mole instead of doing what we should have been doing a year ago. And I'm not a woulda, coulda, shoulda guy.
Which was what, though? What should have been done a year ago?
There are dozens of ways to control mosquito populations in urban areas. And there are new advancements happening every day. And instead of pressing pause or pumping the brakes, they just decided to spray a 20-block area because they want to show that they're doing something. And it's a shame. And the residents here are not going to stand for it. I'm one of, I think, two elected officials on the city level that have expressed their concerns. But we have 90,000 residents, and if I went out and polled all 90,000 of them, I bet you the significant majority of them are very unhappy this morning that this was done.
That's Michael Grieco, who's a Miami Beach commissioner, who, as you can hear there, is very opposed to the spraying of NALID from the air to control mosquitoes in Miami Beach with the Zika virus. Michael, thank you.
No, thank you.
And Here It Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.